I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And what I feel in my heart, they tell sincerely. No other words can tell it half so clearly. Three little words, eight little letters, which simply mean I love
Patricia T. O'Connor is here. She is the author of a number of books on the English language. Woe Is I. Many years later, we got the kids' version of that, Woe Is I, Junior. There's also Words Fail Me and You Send Me, and another book is in the works, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
And she visits us once a month to talk about the English language, and a language that is so rich, there's so much to talk about.
True. But actually, I wanted to talk about yesterday.
Well, there was a lot of language
yesterday.
There
was a lot to talk about, yeah. But usually when there's an over-the-top day like that was, it always inspires a lot of over-the-top language. And I know that listeners always love to hear about mixed metaphors. They're so much fun. But here's a good one about the inauguration. This was sent in by a listener to Late Night Radio, who said that he had heard this on radio when he was up at 1:15, but at any rate, this was the metaphor. Obama has been handed a gauntlet that is half full, if that. How would you like to be handed a wet gauntlet?
Well, it's better than drinking from a slipper, I guess.
I guess so. And
I guess the men chalice.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Exactly. But here's another, this isn't a mixed metaphor, but I happened to be listening in the car for a while yesterday to a weather report, and the meteorologist was talking about the weather in Washington and how it was so wonderful that there was nothing going on, and he said, it's an event-free day. I guess that's how you'd look at it if you're a meteorologist. It's not snowing or raining, so it's event-free.
But it was cold.
Right. And I think we all have our own takes on this sort of event. And Conrad Harrell, whose job was supplying porta potties to the inaugural celebration, said, and I quote, "This is the largest temporary restroom event in the history of the United States." But I thought you might be interested.
That's why they called it historic, you know.
Yes, exactly. Historic on so many levels. And actually, the word inaugural and the word inauguration, the noun, are interesting because they include in them the word augur, as you know, and augury is a prediction based on signs and omens. And to augur, we don't use this much anymore, but to augur, an old verb, was to have an expectation for good or ill. You might say something augurs well, it augurs ill. But
it was like reading the tea leaves, or in the old days, I guess it was looking at bones.
Yes, or entrails, whatever. Whatever signs or
and if things look good, they would say happy entrails to you.
But to augur, the noun, also meant, in the 1500s, to induct or usher into office with auguries.
Hmm.
So if there was an investiture of a bishop or something, they would augur him. And later, only 20 years after that word was introduced, in 1569, it became inaugurate. And it was used to mean for kings and whatnot.
So it's an old word.
It's an old word. To inaugurate meant to ceremoniously induct into office with great auguries.
Well, we didn't get too many auguries yesterday, but we got a lot of predictions, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
And in fact, every pundit had a prediction or two or four, 12.
Right, right. But we don't yet know what kinds of new words President Obama will be ushering into the language, but I wanted to mention some of the new words that have been introduced by past presidents, because some of these sound so relatively modern. But George Washington contributed a lot of words to the language. He contributed indoors, non-discrimination, off-duty, paroled, reconnoiter, bakery, for a place where baked goods are sold, the verb to average, the word ravine, rehire, and hatchet man, although for hatchet man, he meant that as a pioneer, someone clearing the wilderness.
Now, I'm trying to understand how words are introduced like that. I understand mm-hmm. how Shakespeare introduced words mm-hmm. into the language and how the King James Bible did, mm-hmm. but how does a president come up with bakery? And people have to understand what you're referring to, don't they?
Well, it may be that it was already floating in the air, and Washington was the first to use it in a form in which it made its way into print. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, he gets the credit for it. For instance, Thomas Jefferson gets the credit for introducing the word Ottoman, meaning the footstool. Well, the Ottoman Empire had been around for a long time before that, of course, and it was the Ottoman furniture was tufted and it had a Turkish look to it, so it was called Ottoman, but the French had a similar word. But he was the first to use it in English, and so he's credited with having introduced it into the language.
Patricia T. O'Connor is with us. We're talking about the English language, and in a few moments we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What are some of the other words that have been introduced by presidents? George Bush came up with a few,
a few
neologisms, uh-huh. but I doubt that many of those will remain in the language.
Well, you know, he used misunderestimated so many times.
He did it on purpose after he knew that people had pointed out it was not a real word.
So who knows? It may fade away or people may pick it up. We don't know. But some other neologisms from Jefferson are, I think, belittle is a nice word. Hmm. He introduced that, and public relations, electioneering, indecipherable, monotonously, and pedicure.
Really?
Yes. I don't know if he had regular pedicures, but he did introduce that word. He liked inventing words so much that he invented a word for doing that. He invented the word neologize.
Really?
Yes, yes. And his friend John Adams also introduced a lot of words. Lengthy, bobolink for the bird, quixotic, spec as short for speculation, and the verb net in the financial sense he introduced. Abraham Lincoln introduced a few, relocate, relocation, and point well taken, the phrase. Somehow it doesn't sound Lincoln-esque, does it? But he introduced it. Theodore Roosevelt, of course, bully pulpit, and he also invented lunatic fringe, and he popularized muckraker. It had been around, but he really got it into the language. Warren Harding revived two older words, bloviation and normalcy. People made a lot of fun of him for, I think he used normalcy in his inaugural address. And
that was considered an abomination at the time.
Yeah, a lot of snickering. Oh, he meant normality, the idiot.
Now it would just be another example of normalcy.
Right. And FDR invented cheerleader, and Eisenhower gave us military-industrial complex. Mm.
And then it started slowing down.
Yes. I guess all the words had been invented by then.
There are always new words to invent.
Yes.
But perhaps the role of the president has changed over the years. And we did a thing not long ago on how presidential speeches have kind of dumbed down. They've become, as much as possible, kept to two syllables. In fact, JFK was told that was something Lincoln had done, and they thought, well, maybe that's the secret to writing a great inaugural address.
To keeping
the words to two or three syllables at most.
Well, I think short, simple words are often more powerful.
Of course, inauguration is five syllables.
That's right. We could have just stuck with auger.
Let's take some calls. Our number here, 212-433-9692. Gene from Upper Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air. Hello, Gene, are you there? Okay, well, I guess Gene got tired of waiting while we talked about all the words that presidents invented, but I thought that was fun. Steve from the Upper East Side, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard, can you hear me?
Yes.
I was watching the oath yesterday, and I was like stunned when the Chief Justice seemed to garble the words a little bit, and it stunned Obama, I think, for a moment. What happened was the way the oath reads, supposed to read, is it says, I solemnly swear to execute the office of President of the United States. I will faithfully execute the office of the President. But Roberts put the adverb faithfully at the end of all that, so it read, I will execute the office of the President of the United States faithfully. And I always thought you're supposed to put the adverb as close to the verb as you could.
Does it really matter? It sounds to me like they mean the same thing, don't they, Pat?
Well, it matters to Obama because it stopped them dead in the
right.
Track.
Yeah,
well, he knew the correct way.
Well, I do think that if you were just listening to a sentence like that and you had no expectations about it, that if the adverb had trailed that far behind the verb, you'd have to mentally rearrange it a little bit. So I do think that it's more effective communication to put the adverb closer to the verb.
Thank you so much for your call. We go now to Tom from Nyack. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello. I was actually calling. Thank you, by the way, for taking my call. I was actually calling about the auger in the middle of inaugurate. But I was struck because I looked this up for myself in my first edition of the American Heritage Dictionary by the fact that when it got around to the origin part of the definition, it says Latin, inaugurare, to take omens from the flight of birds, which given what happened here in New York over this past weekend, and one, of course, can extend the augury by saying with a competent pilot at the controls that a good outcome will result. I just thought it was particularly interesting
that
the birds were in there.
That is interesting. I hadn't read far enough to find that the signs or auguries had to do with bird flight. But that's very interesting.
I looked in a few different sources, and that was the only one, as I say, the first American Heritage Dictionary that mentioned that specifically, but I was sort of gobsmacked by that.
Gobsmacked, another favorite word of ours. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
And we go now to Toby from Highbridge, New Jersey. Hi, Toby. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard and Patricia. It's an honor to speak to you. I'm sorry to take you so off the presidential course here, but I've just come from a charity where I volunteer, and one of my chores today was doing some proofreading. And I just find that hyphens have become a question mark. There is just no rule, no way to figure out when to use them and when not. I feel I'm often putting them in, and I just don't know. Is there a specific rule or a set of rules regarding when to use
them? I have to tell you about hyphens. Hyphens have a special meaning to me because when I did my first book, Woe Is I, and I did the chapter on punctuation, I thought, okay, a couple pages for commas, a couple pages for semicolons, a couple pages for hyphens. Well, it didn't work out that way. Hyphens went on and on and on and on. And there are there are a few rules, of course. One of them is that if a compound modifier comes before a noun, say long-haired Sally, you hyphenate that. Sally is long-haired, you wouldn't hyphenate. Or this duck is water-resistant, you wouldn't hyphenate. But that's a water-resistant duck, you would hyphenate. So there are rules like that. But over time, hyphenated phrases tend to be the hyphens tend to fall out, and the words tend to become joined together.
There's a novel by Faulkner, one of the later books, I can't remember which one it is, that starts off with a lot of hyphenated words because he loved hyphenated words.
He
loved compound words. But as the book progresses, the hyphens fall out and they become just compound words.
Mm-hmm.
And the explanation for it is that editors were afraid to send anything back to Faulkner and tell him, you know, you're being inconsistent here.
Yeah, he'd probably hang on to the proofs for another 6 months.
Well, I hate to suggest such an abomination, but does it matter then?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it feels like clearly consistency matters, rules matter, but I just see so much inconsistency, and I feel like some sort of a bastion of old tradition to keep putting in hyphens when everyone else is leaving them out.
Well, I think that there are times when hyphens can add to clarity. I mean, what were there hyphens that you're specifically talking about that you thought shouldn't have been there, or that?
Well, it, just from one page to the next, one thing said one on one, and it was hyphenated, and then day to day as a modifier.
Well, I think even modifiers, like here's a good case. 50 years ago, the expression civil rights often was hyphenated before a noun. You'd say, he is a civil rights lawyer. Mm. Today, we assume that that's such a common phrase that we don't need to hyphenate it anymore. So I think once a phrase becomes familiar enough, the hyphens fall out. I think all you can really advise people to do is look at you know, have an up-to-date dictionary and consult it.
Okay.
Thank you for calling us. And we'll be taking more of your calls at 212-433-9692 to Patricia T. O'Connor after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, by the way, spelled O'Connor, author of 4 books on language. I mentioned that a 5th one is soon to be arriving. What is it called?
It's called Origins of the Specious, Myths and Misconceptions of the English Language. See, it's a Darwin year this year, so.
I like it.
Stuart and I wrote it together.
Stuart, your husband, You Send Me With Him. That was the book about language on the Internet.
Yes.
By the way, if you want to put a question to Pat directly, you can use the Internet. You can email her at mailbox@grammarphobia.com, or you can go to grammarphobia.com and click on Pat's blog to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners. And that leads us to the next caller, Bobby from Newark. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, how are you? How are you doing?
I'm okay. And I'm sure Pat's okay.
I'm
speaking for you, Pat.
Thank you.
Hello, Pat.
Hi.
I just wanted to suggest that a possible legacy of George W. Bush would be the plural form of internet, being internets. That he used in a speech. It seems to be a term that's bandied about the Internet quite often.
By people who are referring to that remark of his? Because people are using it in the plural?
They're actually starting to use in regular discussion outside of his referring to him directly. They're starting to say internets.
There is just one internet, though, isn't there?
That is correct. But it's enough. The internet describes a multiple.
It is a network, right?
Connected.
Yeah.
But I guess the term seemed to be popular enough or humorous enough that it's starting to be used in more. I see it being used more and more often in just general discussion and in reference to the internet.
Hmm.
Well, we will see. Although I would hate to see it happen, because I think that there's a place for plurals, a place for singulars, right? I mean,
right.
But we have more confusion with words like media, which really are plural, that become singular.
A lot of words tend to change category. For instance, the word stamina started out as a plural. It meant the various strengths that go to make up the life force of something.
Ending with an A, which is often
a
sign of
ending.
Plural.
Right, right.
Like data.
Exactly.
But nobody says datum anymore.
No, and I actually, the word datum, I believe, exists only in surveying as a measurement. But I'm sure surveyors will call in and correct me. But I think
or miscellaneo.
Data has arrived.
I don't even know what the singular is for miscellanea.
Well, right. There wouldn't be any. But insignia was once plural. Opera was plural. Candelabra was once plural. Now we use candelabrums and candelabra. In English, classical plurals do tend to shift,
and we
become anglicized.
We say the artist worked in many mediums.
Yes, right.
So
yeah,
it's getting more and more confusing, but that's why English is now approaching a million words, I gather, because we just keep on allowing more and more things to happen. I remember when I first started doing this show, and people would debate for hours over whether hopefully should be allowed. Mm-hmm. Now nobody cares one
way
or the other.
I've made my peace with that, and actually I think it makes a lot of sense to allow it as a sentence adverb. How is it different from
luckily
or seriously or oddly or strangely or thankfully? I think it belongs as a sentence adverb.
We go to Rosemary from New York. Hi, Rosemary. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you very much. I'd like to comment on something that I have not made my peace with. I'd like to say how wonderful it is that President Obama will not use incorrectly the object of the infinitive. For example, he'll say to Michelle and myself, which is, I don't think, really correct. It should be, in my opinion, to Michelle and me. Mm-hmm. However, hardly anybody says that anymore. Even in the debates when Clinton and he were asked, what is the difference between you and other one, Hillary Clinton answered, the difference between Barack and I, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, ooh, I wonder what he's going to say. Is he going to say I or me or what?
He can't say I self.
Yeah, he said myself, which is what mostly a lot of people do nowadays. It's a cop-out. In my opinion, I don't know. What does Patricia T. O'Connor think?
Well, I've gotten a lot of mail. There was one very, poignant piece of email I got, and I put it in my blog, actually. The woman said, I love Barack Obama. I worked for him. I voted for him. I adore him. But I can't stand the way he says, for Michelle and I, or with Michelle and I.
I've never
heard
him say
that. Or to Michelle and I. You know, he says that. He does.
Does he?
He does. He does. And I actually did some research, and the last three presidents have, Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton all did that. I must say, however, that the two preceding presidents, George Walker Bush and
Ronald Reagan,
always said, for Nancy and me, or with Nancy and me, or to Barbara and me.
So you think this is a generational thing?
Well, it looks like it, because
what
after
does it
all,
say about me? Because I would never say myself.
Well,
it just means I'm old.
I think you're conscious of the language that you use.
I think it means maybe that you had Latin when you were younger.
No, I didn't even have. I was so bad in French.
Okay, because the Latin thing.
I hardly did well in English.
Object.
Yeah, but look, Barack Obama is a very well-educated man,
absolutely,
very well-read.
Yes.
And yet he does that. I think maybe the writing is on the wall. I'm not making my peace with it or saying that it's going to become sanctioned by usage people, but if, I mean, I adore Barack Obama. I think he's a very smart man, and if he does this, maybe it's hopeless. Who knows?
We go now to Ben. Oh, Jim, I'm sorry. Jim from Brooklyn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Leonard and Patricia. How are you? I wanted to share with you a mixed metaphor from my childhood. I've recalled this and thought it funny for 50 years. I was raised in the Red Hook section of Brooklyn, and this young boy had gone to a boxing match with his father. And we asked him about it. We were about 13 or 14. And he said the guy was beaten to a crisp. I just thought it was one of the funniest things, and I've remembered it for 50 years.
That is funny.
So I just wanted to share that with you, and thank you both very much.
Thank you for calling us. Jean from Montclair.
Hello. I had the great good fortune to be watching the inauguration with a gaggle of writers, and so we had lots of thoughts about the language that we heard. And one thing that really puzzled us was the use of the word hinge point in the invocation, because most of us were unfamiliar with it. And in fact, many people misheard it and thought he had said hinge pin. But in fact, when we looked at the transcripts, it was hinge point.
Hmm.
And we couldn't find a definition in any dictionary, so it doesn't seem to be in common usage. But when I Googled and found some geology textbooks that talk about folding of geological strata and the way they make S-curves, and apparently the spot on the S-curve where the curve changes direction is technically referred to as the hinge point.
Well, how did that work in the sentence in which hinge point was used?
Yeah, I missed that.
He was talking about, I have to paraphrase now, but it was about a hinge point in history.
This is Reverend Lowry's speech?
Excuse me?
This is Reverend Lowry's speech?
No, this is Warren.
Oh.
The invocation.
Oh, I was too busy.
I'm sorry, yesterday's invocation.
Yes.
Ah, you're sure he misspoke and meant linchpin?
Well, we actually, that was part of our discussion, because people thought they heard hinge pin, and then there was a discussion of, well, gee, why would he say hinge pin if it should be linchpin, and is there some association with the word lynch, why he changed it to hinge pin? And then what we saw in the...
He didn't want to say lynch under those circumstances.
Right. In the transcription, we saw hinge point, which actually makes sense if you look it up, but it seems to be a very obscure word. So I guess...
It sounds
really
to me too obscure.
What was the actual word that he said and meant?
I'll bet you anything he meant linchpin.
I was so busy focusing on the religious aspects of the speech that I didn't even notice that.
You're so devout.
I think we can sneak another call in here, just one more. Which one should we do here? Okay, John from Paramus.
It's my lucky day.
It is, John. You don't know how lucky you are. There are millions calling us right now.
I'm sitting in the car waiting. Are they going to pick me? Because I know it's are they going to pick me? Well, anyway, it's always a pleasure to speak to both of you. They had plenty of inaugural balls last night, and I was wondering, where does the word ball come from? Or is it short for ballet, or what does the word ball mean in terms of this dance and whatever?
You would ask something I'm not prepared to ask.
Balls go back a long time in the language, and we've had ballrooms a long time, but I can't think of a Jane Austen novel without a ball. Right?
Yeah.
Little Richard made it into a verb.
What?
Well, good golly, Miss Molly sure knows how to ball. She knew how to dance.
That's a whole different thing. You're right.
What
no,
a
she
dancer.
Was dancing. She was a great dancer.
Let's see. There's a Greek word balazine. There's a late Latin word ballare. There's the old French word bal.
I would think
all
French
means
ball.
A formal gathering for the purpose of dancing.
But I would think it came from the French Because the B-A-L is...
B-A-L-L-E-R in Old French meant to dance.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been
And that's
ballet.
Where ballet probably comes from.
Right.
Oh, very good. Really, I knew I could count
yeah.
you.
So,
thank you.
So we've solved the mystery of ball.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll
talk to you again.
And we will sneak, I think we'll try to sneak another call in here, but you have to make it very brief, Sheila. Hi. Hello, Sheila. Okay, well, that was really brief.
Speaking of ball, I can tell you something very quick.
Yes.
Screwball,
Ooh.
The word meaning nutso,
mm-hmm.
comes from baseball. It's a pitch.
Yes.
Now, I never knew that. Maybe you knew that.
Sure, I did.
You did.
A screwball is usually thrown by a left-handed pitcher, and it is the approximation of a right-hander's curve.
I'll be darned.
So it makes a left-handed pitcher more effective. I'm sure somebody's going to call in and correct me, but I think that's what my memory of screwball is. Meanwhile, we have pretty much run out of time, but again, when can we expect to see your new book?
In early May.
And we'll probably...
From Random House.
And will it give us all sorts of things to talk about on the show?
Oh, it certainly will.
And then people can go to your... to your blog, Grammarphobia. The big problem we mm-hmm. have is that people tell me that they can't get through to you, and that's because they're usually misspelling the word grammar. And
right.
I would have assumed that most listeners to this show would know how to spell the
you
word grammar.
You never know.
but you can go to grammarphobia.com and see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners. You can also ask Pat a question directly by emailing her at mailbox@grammarphobia.com.
I do try to answer everyone, but sometimes it takes me a month or so. But but be patient.
And I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'll
thank
see you,
for
you again
having me.
Next month for more of this,
okay.
February 18th.